The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 22nd of March, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Stephen Williams, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rhea Bold Resources, RBD, ticker there. And Stephen discusses the spudding of their Burnett 2B well within the Monroe Swell Field onshore California. Also on the podcast, Neil Ricketts, Chief Executive Officer of Vesarian, VRS, and Neil provides an update on their operations in the US. And Andy Hollingworth, Chief Executive Officer of Tuple, gives an operational update based on their AGM statement today. And I also have Dr. Dan Gooding, CEO of Newformix, NFX, and Dan talks about the commencement of clinical studies for the company's lead asset, NXP001. And as of Friday, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about Uber, Lyft, Zote Foams, Mercantile Ports and Logistics, and Royal Dutch Shell. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see these, in fact, top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see lots of other content, like a featured article with Block Energy CEO Paul Heywood. There's an interview there, video, at Paul and Podcast yesterday. There's also an interview, of course, question and answer session with Rhea Bold Resources. And there's lots of other content there, voxmarkets.co.uk.
Are you tired of missing news about stock market companies you follow? The Vox Markets app helps investors stay ahead by making sure you never miss an important update. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Stephen Williams, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rhea Bold Resources. RBD is the ticker there. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Justin. Good to be back.
Yeah, well, you've got lots going on, and I was watching a question and answer session on Vox on video, looking two smart professional guys there. But you're very busy at the moment, aren't you?
Yep. I mean, the whole Rhea Bold model is based around consistent high levels of activity. We've always wanted to offer that to investors. You know, we had an RNS this morning about our most recent well that we spurred, and that's our sixth well in the last 7 months.
So yeah, exactly.
We're consistently busy, and that is part of the model.
Well, take us through, just summarize that model. What have you got? What are you involved in at the moment?
So the Rhea Bold concept is still relatively new. We kicked Rhea Bold off about 18 months ago. The idea being to fund other operators' appraisal wells, essentially. So what we do is we look for de-risked assets that are high-quality oil and gas assets in the pre-cash flow stage that have been stuck because of a lack of capital. So we're looking at operators that have got good teams, good assets, but just haven't been able to progress their asset to the next stage because there's a general lack of capital available in this part of the industry. And we then pick out the best ones of those and fund the appraisal wells to really catalyze that activity. So we've done that across a number of different projects. So we then end up with a very diversified, broad portfolio. And we've got assets in the US, in the UK, and in Romania. And as I mentioned, we're now drilling our sixth well, and there's several more to come.
Yeah, so take us through this this bit of news today. Spudding of the second well at Monroe Swell in America. What's happening there?
Yeah, so Monroe Swell is a key asset for us. It's the sort of second of our three California projects. The first was West Brentwood, where we've already drilled two successful wells, VG3, which is has already been put onto production, and VG4, which we're putting onto production very shortly. Successful wells, flowed at extremely high rates. Then we just the other week, announced that we drilled our first well at Monroe Swell. And that was also successful. Now, the Monroe Swell asset is extremely important because Monroe Swell has a lot of running room associated with it. So there's a lot of value to be garnered out of drilling multiple wells at Monroe Swell. And that's precisely why when we saw the result of the first well that we announced recently and how successful that appeared to be, we made the decision to attempt to immediately drill the second one back to back. So we went through an accelerated permitting process. We managed to get the permit in place. Things work very well in the US generally. You can operate much faster in terms of permitting, etc. So we got that permit in place. We kept the rig on location, and that meant we've been able to spud the second well at Monroe Swell almost immediately following the first.
Yes. And so as far as production is concerned, how far off are we from that if everything goes to plan?
So VG3 is a good example. It went onto production. It's weeks rather than months from the initial or from the discovery and the testing of those wells. VG4 has been a little bit slower. The reason for that is VG4 flowed at such high rates that the gas that came out with the oil is too large a quantity to flare. So we have to plug the gas into the nearby gas pipeline. Now, that's clearly a good problem to have because it means we're getting a lot of oil production and we also can sell the gas. So it's increased value, but it's meant it's taken a few weeks of additional time between the successful drilling and putting it onto production because there's a gas tie-in. We don't anticipate anything like that at Munro Swell. So these will be the situation here should be that there are, again, it's just a few weeks between making the successful discovery, then having the test and then putting it onto production.
Yeah, and like you said, it's, you know, you're relatively new to the market. The model's quite new. I mean, are you happy with how it's going so far?
We are very happy in terms of what's happened within the business. You know, the first thing we had to do was access capital. We managed to do that successfully, but with a successful or a couple of successful fundraisers. Then we had to build a portfolio of opportunities, and we felt we did that very successfully. We had to deliver activity. We've clearly done that with this being our sixth well. And then we needed to see if the wells were actually going to be successful. And on the whole, we've had extremely good results across the portfolio with the majority of wells making discoveries. The only thing we've been a little bit frustrated by is the share price. The share price, for various reasons, has been underperforming of late. You mentioned at the start, I think, that we were on a Vox video that came out yesterday where we discussed that in a bit more detail. We're a little bit frustrated by it, but we think it'll solve itself when we can start really demonstrating the cash flow that's coming out of these Californian assets.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's summarize this in 3 points, if you could, Stephen, for people not following the story yet. Give them those 3 reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, firstly, you know, as we've said, we've just spud another well, and the result of that will be out within a couple of weeks. So there's another meaningful well result to look out for, which is coming imminently. Secondly, I think the value opportunity, as we just touched on, I think there is a specific opportunity right now to get involved in Rehobald at an extremely attractive valuation. And thirdly, you know, the high level of activity we continue to have across our portfolio. So after this well, we've then got the very high-impact Grizzly Island project in California, which we also drilled this year. We've got a very exciting well onshore UK at West Newton, which is planning to drill next month. And then we've got an extremely low-risk re-drill of an existing discovery in Romania, which we'll drill in June. So lots going on, lots of wells, lots of positive catalysts in the portfolio. And we think that's an exciting story for investors.
Absolutely. Excellent stuff, Stephen. Good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll catch up again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Neil Rickett, CEO of Vesarion. VRS is the ticker there. Neil, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Justin. Always a pleasure to talk to you, as you know.
Yes, and you've done an update for the US of A, and you mentioned you know, a while back you'd started to sort of expand in the US, but it's a more comprehensive expansion. As always, Neil, before we get into this, let's say someone's tuning in right now and they hear the word Vesarion. What's it all about?
So we're an advanced materials company. We specialise in taking technology out of UK universities, things like graphene, and turning them into commercial products. And that's why this announcement today is so important, because America is a massive market like China. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we've got to be in these territories in order to really get the benefit of this technology.
Yeah, so you announced, you know, a while back, I don't remember when, that you started appointed some certain boards and industries and councils out there. Explain your involvement in the US as to date before this then, Neil. What was happening there?
Okay, so it's been an evolving plan over a couple of years. As I always say to everybody, these things take time. You have to, it's been like growing plants, you know, you have to sow the seeds and then you have to nurture them and then eventually they turn into beautiful flowers. Well, this is what we're doing here. And what we've done up to now is we went to a few exhibitions. We had a look at what the demand was likely to be. We did a lot of research. Then we had one of the friends of the business, someone that we'd known for a long time, someone that we trusted, helping us out in the US with those inquiries, a guy called Marco. And Marco was doing really, really well, and he was turning those things. But unfortunately, Marco couldn't work full time. So the natural thing is for us to continue to develop those links to the point where we can appoint someone who's got a track record in, you know, the areas in which we're trying to exploit graphene, so carbon fiber composites, racing. And again, you know, we're really interested in working with people that we want to work with, people that we know, people that we trust. And we brought Patrick on board, who has a lot of commonality with my career, having worked with McLaren in the past, and some of the common companies in the racing industry and some of the other industries. Patrick's got a, you know, fantastic career. He was a captain in the U.S. Marines. He he's a proper veteran. He's then had a career with BASF and Huntsman and all of these good guys that are potential clients for us. So, you know, Patrick's come on board, slightly different take on things. He's come on full time. We've got an office set up already. We've got the company incorporated in America. And we're in the process of setting up a laboratory to be our kind of application center in the US. So yeah, there's a lot of work going on in the background to even get it to this stage. And now it's all about letting Patrick loose and developing those leads that we've had and talking to the customers that we're already talking to.
Yeah, and you can assume, because he's a captain of the Marines, he's quite organized, I assume.
Frighteningly so. He is a true sales professional. He's run his own consultancy. He's got, a great breadth of experience. But you know, he's a killer in the sales field. You know, he's out there to make a name for himself and to share in the glory of what we're doing. We also have, you know, huge amounts of support from the National Graphene Association, and you know, we're getting ready, and this announcement is really fortuitous that we've got the support of Senator Wicks, and we're out to Capitol Hill to talk to people about what's going on in America and how America can catch up with some of the other nations like China and like the UK and Europe. So great timing, really great strategy, really starting to play out now. Everything's starting to accelerate with our plans in China, America, Korea, Japan, India. You know, it's we're not sure what things to do at the moment, Justin.
Yeah, exactly. What's the ideal scenario then, as far as America's concerned?
It's all about contract wins. So we have some American people that we've signed collaboration deals with. We've got a very, very full hopper. We need that extra bandwidth in order to be able to cope with what's going on. It's not sustainable to be trying to work on three different time zones on your own. So that's why we're expanding the team with Bruno in China, who's doing a fantastic job. Rachel, who's doing a fantastic job in Korea and was over last week. And then we've got Patrick in the US, and he's already hit the ground running. And as I said, you know, we're not starting from scratch. We already have clients, and he already has people that he wants to talk to as well. So we just got to get on with stuff now.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice, Neil. Okay, as always, three quick reasons, if someone's listening, you know, why they should add you to their watch list, please.
So I think we've got a unique proposition in the contacts and connections that we've got, the National Graphene Association, our links with the University of Manchester and the National Graphene Institute and the Graphene Engineering Innovation Centre and the University of Cambridge and a number of other key UK universities, notwithstanding our connections with the Department of Trade and central government. The second thing is that, you know, we are building up a reputation for delivering on things. Now we're delivering on the international strategy we talked about, and it's hard enough doing one territory, but when you're doing multiple territories, it puts a lot of pressure on the team, but we're starting to see the benefits of that. And the third thing is I'm the largest holder, and therefore all of my aims and aspirations and ambitions are all aligned with those of the long-term holders.
Marvellous stuff, Neil. Good to chat to you, and no doubt we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Andy Hollingworth, Chief Executive Officer of Tuple. That's T-O-O-P ticker. Andy, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Justin.
Yeah, it's been a busy day there. You've had the AGM and released a statement, which is very positive on the business, and we'll get into the detail of that in a bit. Before we do, Andy, as always, if someone's tuning in for the first time to the podcast and not familiar with Tuple, just explain what Tuple's all about, please.
Yeah, certainly. Tupl are a dedicated small business provider for the UK telecoms market. We provide telecoms connectivity like superfast broadband, Ethernet connectivity, mobile connectivity like mobile SIMs and cloud-based telephony, always on a fixed price contract to the UK small business, which is typically businesses with under 50 employees, all backed up by our own Merlin provisioning and billing platform that interconnects with all the UK carriers, making us completely carrier agnostic.
And
that gives, you know, obviously that gives small businesses the choice rather than one particular UK carrier.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so last time we spoke, this is after end of years, I think it was, and you had an excellent October breaking records, and November was going very well. It broke, I think, records again. And December, you did say beforehand, you said, well, December's going, started well, but, you know, with December, like, very disruptive with Christmas and all that stuff. So how did December go, Andy?
Yeah, I think since our last end of year results, obviously we concluded December. December, whilst you never break records in December, actually December surprised us in terms of the orders that we took in. In fact, it was 300% up on December 2017. So exceptional compared to for a seasonal low month, a 300% increase year on year.
Yeah, and it seems like this has continued in January and February as well. Is that right? The uptick.
Yeah, 2019 has started very, very strong. You can see that from the time of our last set of results, we are in material growth. So you can see that January has grown by 242% over last January. February, 243% over last February. So month on month, we are in material growth as a business. We sit here now with a week to close out in March, and we already know that March will be a record month again for us. Yeah. So our digital marketing is working really well. Every single customer that we get to talk to, we're converting over 80% of all of those conversations.
Wow. How is that conversion so successful? How is it so high?
Because I think there's a difference with Tupl. A lot of the providers in the UK market use what we call retail price index increases during the life of the contract. Tupl are very, very simple in terms of we are fixed price for the duration of the contract. All of our customers, over 90% of our customers base, sign a minimum 2-year contract. Why? Because they want transparency, they want fixed pricing for the life of the contract, and they want all that backed up by UK onshore support. Never forget that broadband connectivity is really a utility and it's critical to a small business. And Tupl are delivering on that and also delivering on excellent customer experience scores, you know, as measured by the independent company Trustpilot. Look at the Tupl scores and you can see that not only do we give great disruptive fixed pricing, but in life we give customers a great experience. That is making a difference against the rest of the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And you signed a big sort of deal last year, but for $3.5 million, which is like, you know, bigger than the value of your company. That's starting to be integrated now, isn't it, onto the platform?
Yes, certainly. We actually transferred over the first batch of customers and they've completed and gone to billing. And actually, I'm just about to leave the offices here to go and see them again because the second 200 batch of customers is due to land this afternoon and start getting provisioned over the weekend on the Merlin platform. So on track and as expected.
Yeah, well, I had someone approach me on social media saying they probably need to raise cash soon. And you say here your cash position remains in line with management expectations.
Yeah, let's quash that straight away. We absolutely do not need to raise cash. If I remember from the fundraise that we did last September, we absolutely made a statement at that fundraise that those funds were enough in the board's opinion to see us through to cash generation. Nothing has changed in any way, shape or form, and our cash position remains absolutely in line with our expectations and our working capital forecasts. So let me be really clear, we are not in the market looking or needing to raise any funds at all.
Yeah, excellent stuff. It seems like you said, as Richard says there in the statement, it seems like your strategy, you're happy with it, it's working.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, if we talk about this time last year, we were transitioning from outsourced sales to inside sales with our own sales team. We went through that transition really quickly. And I sit here now a year down the road, absolutely starting and telling you that 85% of every single customers we talk to, we actually convert and they end up signing a contract with Tuple.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Well, so, Andy, what's your ambition here? What's going to happen here with Tuple? Because you seem to be growing quickly and going very well. What's your ambition?
Well, the ambition is, if you look at that UK small business market, you know, there's 5.5 million small businesses out there in the UK. Mm-hmm. Our ambition over the next 3 to 5 years is to take 5% of that market. That would make us a significant business in customer base size and in revenue size.
Absolutely. So one final thing, Andy, three reasons. If someone's listening to this right now, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Certainly. Number one, we are absolutely a material growth business. You can see that from the numbers and from the reports. Number two, this is solid revenue growth that is all contracted annuity revenue, with over 90% of that annuity revenue on minimum 2-year contracts. And number three, we're very fortunate. We have a board and a leadership team with significant sector experience in both organic and M&A growth. It's a great reason to buy into Tuple.
Excellent stuff. Andy, good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Certainly. Thank you very much for your time, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dr. Dan Gooding, Chief Executive Officer of Nuformix. NFX is the ticker there. Dan, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
Pleasure to speak to you again, Justin.
Yeah, you've had some significant news out today, and in fact, you've had quite a bit of news over the last few months. We haven't caught up, but lots going on there. And before we get into this, Dan, significance of your clinical trial starting on NPX001, before we get into the detail of that, just give us a brief summary. What is Nuformix about for someone who's listening for the first time or not heard of you?
Of course. So Nuformix is a Cambridge-based pharmaceutical development company. We have a unique approach to the redevelopment of known drugs. So the redevelopment of known drugs for new uses offers a different risk profile than you'd usually associate with companies in our sector. We have lead programs in oncology, supportive care, and fibrosis. And our business model is one where we look to develop products up to a proof of concept at patient level before then out licensing to marketing partners who will take those products onwards for registration.
Okay, excellent stuff. I mean, you say the risk profile, you think is essentially less risk because it's and also when you take it forward, you're looking to license it out to bigger companies for a bigger payment up front. Is that right? You know, depending on the size of the market, you know?
That's right. So I think if you look at the two demographics in the market that are really key, okay? Number one is looking at the rate of approval of new products. Now, typically, your average success rate in the pharmaceutical company is about 5%. So one out of 20 products that are developed actually succeed. And those products usually fail because of issues around safety, or misunderstood issues around how a drug might work in treating a new disease. So when we start with a known drug, we can already discharge that first safety risk. Mm-hmm. Secondly, because we know so much more about what known drugs do in patients in the body, we can take much more informed views about how we might like to redevelop them for those new uses. So we completely change the risk profile for how one develops products in our space. The other side of things is that, you know, understanding that that's how the pharmaceutical industry works in terms of developing new products. Large pharmaceutical companies look to in-license things that have been developed to a proof of concept from other smaller biotech companies. And that's also our model. And it's just how the industry works.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on to this then. So you've started clinical trials for NXP001. This is your lead asset. Just tell us what it is and the size of the market here, Dan, if you could.
Yeah, of course. So obviously delighted to announce this is the start of our first clinical trial, something that we've been working on for a little while. But we've been able to kick that off just this week. And NXP1 is a product which we have in development for chemotherapy, nausea, and vomiting. So this is a side effect that a very large number of people receiving, very unpleasant side effect that a very large number of people have when receiving chemotherapy. So the oncology supportive care market within which CIMV sits is worth about £16 billion currently during this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this when you start this clinical trial, you've got to explain, you are sort of getting revenue from this product already, aren't you? Because you've signed a deal with a Chinese licensing partner, is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. So for NXP1, this is a very fast market, fast to revenues kind of product, because what we're doing is we're actually generating a version of a product that's already sold within this space. We have already done a deal on that asset for Chinese marketing rights. And on the completion of this study, which will take place in around about 2 months, we'll see our first major commercial milestone from that agreement, a payment of about £2 million, which for a company with a really low burn rate like ours, you know, is a significant amount of money and really increases our run rate and our ability to invest into our portfolio. However, having got that human data that demonstrates that we can use NXP1 to enter the oncology supportive care market, we'll then be able to complete deals for rest of world rights with other potential commercial partners.
Okay, so this is obviously a very significant event. How long will these clinical trials take then, Dan?
We expect to release data in about 2 months. So we expect to certainly have results and payment of the milestone during the first half of the year.
Okay, excellent stuff. And so it's quite an exciting time for you, isn't it?
Very exciting, yeah. You know, this is something, as I say, that we've been working towards for a while. I think you know, there's a lot of validation, therefore, of our ability to take our technology, take our assets into the clinic quickly without having to generate new safety data. Certainly, this validates that aspect. And with the shortness of the trial, I hope that we can really demonstrate quickly that our technology can work, but that also that we can generate significant revenues from it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So if this goes well, I mean, like you say, there's a proof of concept and the potential for to commercialize it massively, isn't it?
I think we're going to selectively develop Nuformix in terms of its portfolio. The view, I think, for Nuformix is not to build, you know, a very cash consumptive business with very large numbers of very long, expensive clinical trials, but to cherry pick a number of assets going forward in our portfolio where, with some very discrete work on proof of concept clinical studies, we can use that resulting data to complete licensing transactions across our portfolio, maybe even achieve a trade sale as an exit. So that's the kind of bigger picture, and this is the start of that process.
Yeah, and at the moment, you've got what? So you've got, obviously, NXP1 is your lead product. You've got NXP2 as well, NXP3, and so you've got a pipeline there, haven't you?
We have, and there's also work going on, obviously, behind that to build up that portfolio with a few more assets as we continue to work in the technology area in which we specialise.
Marvellous stuff. Okay, Dan, well, one final thing here to do. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of what you're talking about and the progress you're making, but are not following the company, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay. Well, I think, as I've just talked about, really, the fact that we've been able to announce this clinical study commencement really describes that we're now doing exactly what we set out to do. We have the strategy of sort of faster clinic. The technology is obviously acceptable to regulators. They allow us to do that. And what that bodes for our future pipeline, as we've just discussed. We have, the second reason would be our faster market, faster revenue model. We've got significant income on completion of our trial, and that data is going to support completion of other deals for rest of world rights, as we've just discussed. And licensees are going to be able to use our products to get new products to market faster. So it's a faster market, faster revenue model. Lastly, I think there's significant upside across our portfolio. I think there's a disconnect between the valuation of our business and the value of our business. And as our portfolio progresses forward into sort of more high value indications such as fibrosis, I mean, that's going to be very exciting now that our ability to get to clinic is validated.
Excellent stuff. And one thing I know I always look for, Dan, as an investor, is whether the CEO has skin in the game. Because essentially, I think, if I got a CEO coming on the podcast, give it the big sell on their product, and they don't have any skin in the game, they go, hang on a sec, why haven't you taken advantage of the opportunity you're talking about? So, and you do have shares, you own shares, don't you?
Yeah, no, we do. It's not just me, but the entire management team. As co-founders of the business, we all hold around 10% shareholding in the business. So absolutely, committed to success of the business too. And I don't have people familiar with the route by which we came to market. It was via reverse takeover. We've just seen expiry of a 50 million warrant clause within that RTO. And I think, for shareholders, that just demonstrates that I think that two things: we're avoiding significant dilution events, but also the company's getting to a point where, it can really stand on its own two feet and go forward with revenue that it's generating from outlicensing activities on its own.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff, Dan. Good to chat to you. And like I say, you're in the clinic now, so hopefully more news inbound. So no doubt we'll be catching up again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
I look forward to that, Justin. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
I'm very well, Justin. How are you, my friend? You okay?
I'm good. Do you know what? You joined me for lunch. You joined me for lunch the other day.
Really?
I'll tell you how this happened. Normally, I have a break for lunch-ish, around about sort of quarter past one, ish. And I tune into Sky Business. And
That'll be how. Okay,
There's. I said, hang on, that's a familiar face. I said, my wife, that's Russ Mould. He's on the podcast every week.
There we go.
Nice to see you there.
I've been on Ian King Live because the Sky Studio is 5 minutes from our office London Bridge. So it's quite cool. One London Bridge is the News Corporation building, and Ian King's up on the 14th floor of that. So. It's very convenient for me to get to, except that getting in and out of the building is extremely difficult because security is very tight.
Yeah, it's got to be the stadium.
As you can imagine.
Yeah. Who's this guy? It's okay, I'm investment director at Stockbroker AJ Bell.
All right, we'll let him in then.
let him in.
That's enough of that business.
He may be able to make us some money or stop us helping us losing money. Right, so let's say, I mentioned today, actually, on the podcast I did this morning, five things you need to know, is that Uber, it looks like, has picked the New York Stock Exchange to list. They reckon in excess of $100 billion, I reckon, and Lyft as well, its rival, NASDAQ, they're listing, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lyft actually prices on the 28th of March. I think the initial price range is $62 to $68. That'll give it a valuation in the mid-$20 billion range. Uber, as you say, people are talking about a $100 billion plus valuation, which is interesting. There was a funding round done, which SoftBank did in December 2017, that was very carefully structured because there'd been a round where the Saudi sovereign wealth fund had got involved. That had valued Uber at $69 billion. Technically, the SoftBank investment actually valued the company at $48 billion. It was a down round, but they bought money in two tranches, one of which valued the company at $48 billion, one of which valued it at $69 billion. So Uber was able to say it wasn't a down round, and now they seem to be shooting for this $100 billion plus figure. It last year, remember, it had annual sales of $11.3 billion US dollars and a loss of $1.8 billion dollars.
Yeah, well, do you know what? That does bring me to the thing. I like small micro cap companies, and I dabble a lot in those, and I look at potential. And when it comes down to it, how do you value those? Because there's no real strict way of valuing those companies. But you look at balance sheets of cash is the most important thing, really. If they got cash, how long are they going to last for? And then the potential and all that stuff. But I also look at shareholder registers and all that to see, if the CEO, CFO and all that, if they have a big chunk in, I'm more likely to believe the company than if they don't. But with something like Uber, it's got revenues, making a lot of money, a lot of loss. So how do you value, how do they get to that figure of $120 billion or whatever, $100 billion?
Well, the only way in which you can, you mentioned the magic word, which is potential, because that's clearly what you're pricing in. You're assuming that right now it's involved in a massive land grab for customers. Don't forget, it's pulled out of Russia, it's pulled out of China, it's pulled out of Southeast Asia. It's accepted stakes in Didi Chongqing in China and Grab Taxi in Southeast Asia in response for pulling out. So it's being a bit more focused, because at the moment, the more customers it's got, the more money it's losing, which, let's face it, is not a model that's going to run for the long term. So the assumption is clearly at some stage they're going to get sufficient economies of scale through the platform that they will start to turn a profit. And I'm sure they'll also talk about the optionality of the data, the value of the data that they've got. And they're not just in car sharing. They've got the scooter businesses, Jump and Line, that they've bought. There's Uber Delivery and Uber Eats. And they're talking about themselves as a transport and logistics platform, not just a transport company, whereas Lyft is saying, look, we're just a ride-sharing company, that. Okay, so there is a difference between the two. Now, so if you're looking at a company that right now is losing money, there are a number of ways you can do it. You can sort of value it on a per customer basis, but You know, but in the end, what you, if you're being really ruthless about it, you build what's known as a discounted cash flow model, where you look at the company, you look at what you think its trend growth is going to be top line, what you think its operating margin will be over the fullness of time, and you will then, having made those, and then you will then have to assume what its spending will be, which in Uber's case should, on balance, be relatively limited in terms of capital investment. So then you've got a cash flow number. Very crudely, you'll have operating profit, you'll be knocking off cash flow, working capital, you'll be knocking off capex, working capital, and adding back depreciation, if there is any. And then you've got a cash flow number. You will then look to build that out over 10 or 20 years, assuming terminal, you know, trend growth rates and terminal growth rates. You will then choose an interest rate that you think is appropriate right now to discount those future cash flows back to current levels. You'll also have to assume an equity risk premium to work out your discount rate. You'll factor in what you think is a suitable long-term cost of debt, which right now is warped by quantitative easing and everything else, and a suitable equity risk premium for a cost of equity. And then you can have a guess at what multiple you're applying for the residual value. So very easily, you are calculating future cash flows, having a guess at what a real interest rate is, what the equity risk premium is, and the multi-year residual value of the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do you know what? At the end of the day, I try and buy it at the 52-week low.
Well, yeah, what I would say is, as we guessed, in principle, it all sounds very relatively straightforward. It's just maths, but the number of assumptions that you're making in there are clearly enormous, and the chances of any of your initial estimates being pretty good are very odd. One of the things, though, that are very small, one thing that does justify such a large valuation is the fact that right now interest rates are at near zero, and the model is hugely sensitive to what interest rate you use. That's where, you know, the bulk of the cash flow is clearly with the loss-making company, and in the now, they're in the future. And so the rate at which you discount those cash flows back to get a present value is massively sensitive to the interest rate that you assume. So if you always assume that the Fed interest rate is going to peak out at 2.5%, you'll get a massive difference if you assume the Fed's going to eventually normalize rates and sink back to 5, 6, 7, 8. Mm-hmm. So I think lots of these companies are looking like they're worth a lot because of the current monetary policy environment. I think if that were the case, these companies wouldn't be attracting anything like the valuations that they're attracting. Now, Uber's coming now, as you've said, because Lyft is coming next week on the 28th of March with its pricing. The market's had a massive run since the December 24 low in the US, the December 27 low in the UK. And it's not just Lyft and Uber who are looking to come from this tech inverted commas space. Slack, Postmates, Pinterest, Airbnb, Plantier, as well as Uber, and they're all coming. So there is a window, but lots of companies are looking to clamber through it. And if you're looking at the valuations that these companies are talking about, and maybe the money that they're going to raise, I would think that septet would easily exceed the $45 billion peak that was raised by technology companies in 2000, just before the tech bubble collapsed. Now,
top of the market.
Dear listeners, that is not advice. I am merely saying, just
Russ Moulton's
back.
Top of the market.
To be fair, I did think that when somebody paid £1 million for a flying pigeon, for a racing pigeon this week.
Absolutely. Do you know what? It's amazing. If you're going to buy that, one of your risks is cats, you know, and that's one of the risks you have to put down. Yeah. So it's unbelievable. Because I think this happened before. When Alibaba came to market, didn't we have a top of the market, and it was a bit of a sell-off after that? Because what happens is, I interviewed a guy who wrote a book on IPOs, and he said there's always a chance to get a better price in the market. Because what happens is, the mechanic is, everyone has to pump the stock. You know, everyone's getting money from this. They have to pump this up. They have to get it away, you know? So, obviously, you'll see lots of headlines singing, this is a good deal. You get in the market now, you learn a quick 20, 30%, you know? And you'll see all this nonsense. But you give it time, you'll probably be able to pick up the stock a lot cheaper than it is at the IPO, you know?
My suspicion, if the hype cycle does its thing, the stock could easily rocket, and there will then be a period of disappointment. It will come down, and that may be... And we will see. I'm not giving advice, but it's just... Because I'm old enough to have seen quite a few cycles now, it's the sort of thing that just naturally puts you on alert, shall we say.
And let's be honest, that's it. It cycles. The market goes up and down. And like I said, a rising tide, you know. So these companies will come down quickly and go up with the market. So there's always opportunities. And that's why the market's good. It always presents you with opportunities. It's just, you know, when everyone's, like Warren Buffett said, when everyone's scared and the market's down, people don't buy. That's when you should be buying. When everyone's bullish.
This is it. That's the old Benjamin Graham thing. It's his Mr. Market analogy. Mr. Market comes and knocks on your door.
Yeah.
One day he'll offer you a higher price. one day he'll offer you a lower price. And you know, obviously the times you'll be buying is the lower price. And I try and say to my friends, look, if a shop stands there and puts a big sign in its window saying discount 50% off, you're interested, right? Mm-hmm. But with share prices, you only get interested when they've just gone up 50%. Please explain.
It's the fear of missing out, is the greed. And,
Bing.
Okay, so let's get into it. So individual stocks, what are you looking
individual
at?
Individual stocks. So two tiddlers, one of which we've talked of before, which is Zotefoams.
Yeah.
And then one which we've not talked about before, which is Mercantile Port and Logistics. And then the income stock we're going to look at is Shell.
Lovely.
Stodgy Shell.
Yeah, yeah, cool. So what's...
So Zotefoams, a ZTF, it's a FTSE small cap market. It caps about 300 million. We spoke about it about a month ago, and they've just had their full year results, so it's just worth picking up on that.
Yeah.
Remember, this is a chemical specialist, lightweight foam materials. They actually call themselves cellular material specialists. And this is the company whose products are used in aviation, transport goods, sport shoes, and their customers include Nike, BMW, and NASA, which I think is what caught your attention last time.
Yes.
So, the company's been growing very rapidly indeed, and the full year figures have confirmed that. Sales up 16%, pre-tax up 23% to new record highs. Sneaked up the dividend a little bit, but that's 6p on a share price of 6 quid, so that's not really the issue here. But the good news is that the high-performance business grew very quickly. The footwear business was and the aviation business was up 60-odd percent, and that's really the growth driver going forwards. They've expanded a factory in Kentucky in the U.S., they're expanding capacity in the UK and Poland, which they funded with a fundraising last year. So that at the moment, it seems as if the growth story is very good. They do point out volatile currencies are a potential nuisance and the macro environment's uncertain. So you've got to be careful because this is a stock trading on nearly 30 times forward earnings. So the growth's in the window and the growth potential is there. Some of it, at the very least, is in the price. And we all know with very high growth stocks, if there's any disappointment, you're going to get a potential trouble. So this is not for value seekers. This is a Momo stock. It's a well-run company. The momentum seems strong. So, jockeys may well choose to keep running with it.
Well, do you know what? The chart looks always nice. It's come back to, it had those results, came back a little bit to the, 50-day moving average. Mm. It hasn't gone below that, but it's come back to a nice little support there. And, in that gradual sort of climb upwards. So it's come back.
There you go.
So,
touch wood.
It hasn't gone below that for a long time. So definitely.
Yeah, so watch out if it does, I suppose. But
I suppose so. But it seems like it's going to carry on with that. Okay, as long as they keep, obviously, producing the results.
That's the secret, yeah.
Yeah, MPL, what's there?
Right, well, have a look at the chart, mate, and tell me what you think. Okay. It's gone from £2.50 to 2p.
Wow, what a bargain.
Now, you like buying stocks at 52-week lows, Justin.
No, well, do you know what?
Here's your chance,
buddy. It depends on what they're doing. Hang on, I have heard about these before.
This is it's interesting. This is high-risk stuff, so this is not widows and orphans, and I think it needs some careful research, but what's just caught my eye is they did a refinancing late last year, and in fact, it's their third refinancing.
Oh, okay.
Over the period of time since it floated at £2.50 in October 2010, it's raised £150 million, this company. The market cap is now barely 50.
Is this based in India, these ports and stuff?
It's Mumbai's third port.
Yes, someone's...
And there have been all sorts of environmental protests, construction delays on the 100-plus acre site, but... It's now finished. There's actually been an opening ceremony just this month or late last month. So it looks like we're through construction risk. The thing is actually open. They've had trial customers come in. I think there are two customers committing now to volumes. And as we all know, if you can get a port to work, this is a great business because ports just don't spring up every day of the week, as this company has indeed proven over the last 9 years. So it's Mumbai's third port. We know the Indian growth story. There's a road straight from Mumbai up to Delhi. So there's a huge reason for the need for the infrastructure. But this is, in the end, not just a profit that's pre-profits. It's a company that's still pre-revenues. So this is, a very niche angle for certain types of investors only. But the fact that they've done a refi, the fact that they've actually got some customers now trialing it out, we might start to see some revenues. If ever you're looking for a bombed out stock that's not just at a 52-week low, but a 452-week low.
Yeah. Well, I've put it on a watch list. I've added it on Vox.
I've hit the
follow button to see, just keep up.
So let's see. Let's just follow the news flow on that one, I think.
Someone did suggest those to me about 2 years ago, I think. Pretty long on that. So,
that'll hurt.
Okay, so what's last? Is it Royal Dutch Shell?
So income, bit of income. Royal Dutch Shell, yeah. And this is just a classic income play. Yeah. I mean, it's the records, as far as I can't find them, they must be lost in the mist of time. But everywhere you read, Shell has not cut its dividend since the Second World War.
Yes.
So that famous, you know, famous. So that is, I mean, certainly I've gone back as far as I can, and that's fine. It currently pays $1.88 a share a year. That's enough for around a 6% dividend yield on the stock, and actually translates cash-wise into £11.5 billion a year at current exchange rates, or 12% of the FTSE 100's dividend all on its own, intriguingly. Wow. Now, so they actually managed to hold that dividend when oil was at $30. Now oil's at $60. That certainly takes some of the pressure off. Earnings covers look still a bit thin, you would say, at 1.5 times, but free cash flow covers improved a lot. Debt is coming down. And I know we're all worried, you know, from an investment point of view, you'd be worrying about peak oil. From a consumer's and planet's point of view, we're obviously all looking forward to that enormously. But I suspect that hydrocarbons are going to be with us for an awfully long time to come. There's a lot more residual value in this company. There's oil fields, therefore, than you think. And it is also developing its renewables and non-hydrocarbon fuels.
Diversifying,
so,
isn't it?
Yeah. There you go. So you wouldn't want to necessarily bet against them having the wherewithal to reinvent themselves over time. But certainly for the next, in the short to medium term, you would like to think, if you are looking for a relatively reliable payer of dividends, Shell will be pretty close up your list.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I've always having a price alert, if it hits a certain price, I sometimes, you know, I decide to invest or not, because I think, well, it's the dividend's there, it's been there since World War II. And also with Shell, I think it was a very telling, the Norwegian Sovereign Fund divested a lot of oil and gas juniors recently, didn't they? But they didn't divest from the big players that have other things in the pipeline, like new renewables.
That was the reason. That was the biggest thing. They felt they had the cash flow to reinvest in renewables and reshape the future of the planet.
Yeah, and let's be honest, if any smaller companies come up with some ingenious ideas, it's companies like Shell will just buy them up, you know?
That's what I would personally assume, yes.
It's the same with Google. It's like tech companies, isn't it now? Any company, that, you know, like Facebook, WhatsApp and all that stuff, anyone that has any kind of platform or any threat to them or any growth potential going forward, they just buy them up. So, you can play diversity that way rather than look for small
that's what
tech
I'd assume.
Companies. Yeah. Marvellous stuff. Thanks for that, Russ. Any plans
Not
for the
all.
Weekend?
Taking my lad to watch Lewis FC play tomorrow, playing Kingstonian in a Bostic League match, which is third tier of the football non-league. We'll go for a pub lunch beforehand in the Rights of Man pub in Lewis, which is all that, you know, because obviously Tom Paine was from Lewis and he helped promote and write some of the American Declaration of Independence. So that's all very historical and very famous. Yeah. And then, I don't know, I think we'll go around to our mates for a curry on Saturday night, actually, which would be quite jolly. So what about you?
That sounds excellent. A bit of football, a bit of food. That's not nice. Well, do you know what? As yet, we're not that far advanced and planned. We're doing, do you know what? In fact, we're spending a bit of time at home. We haven't the last couple of weeks been away this way, so it's nice to have a bit of time at home, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. You know? Feet up.
Probably get a curry and watch me and the wife watch this drama on TV Friday night, probably.
There you are.
Lovely. Thanks for that, Russ. Speak soon.
Take care.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are as follows. At five, it's Eland Oil and Gas. Ticker there is ELA, of course. I didn't know it. At four, Bell Zone Mine, BZM, ticker there. At three, Trinity Exploration and Production, TRIN, is it ticker there? At two, Rockhopper Exploration, RKH, is it ticker there? And the number one most followed company is Hummingbird Resources, HUM. Down to 21.4 pence at the moment. Of course, a gold producer. We've had them on the podcast many a time. Hopefully they'll come again very soon too. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Angus Energy, operations update, rig contract for Brockham. At four, Makanga Resources, Makanga Files technical report. At three, Tuple, had Andy on the podcast, AGM statement. At two, i3 Energy, operational and financial update. And at one is on this podcast today, Stephen from Rehabilitation Resources, spudding of second well at Monroe Swell. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.